Welcome to the Radio Book Club. It's a collaboration between KGNU Community Radio and the Boulder Bookstore. And we have an extra special edition of the Radio Book Club this month. There were so many wonderful books to choose from, but this one we couldn't miss an opportunity to speak with the author in person. Tiari Jones is the author of the book Silver Sparrow, but her latest book is An American Marriage. And my co-host Arsene Kashkashian joining us in the studio with Tiari Jones. It's good to have you both with us.
Thank you.
Yeah, very excited.
Well, tell us, first of all, we always start by Arsene talking a little bit about why this book has been selected and why readers should get excited about reading it.
Well, it's a really great book, and it's about, life going on now. It's kind of a love triangle with one of the men in the triangle incarcerated, and I think it touches upon a lot of current events, a lot of things that are going on in society right now. But more than that, it's just a great story. It's well written. And as we were talking, we won't get into the details, but it's one of those rare books where the author has nailed the ending. You raise your fist and you're just so happy about how well she ended this book.
Well, we're not going to give away the ending.
We won't give that away, but I can tell people that it's coming. Just keep reading.
And it could have gone anyway. And Tiari Jones, a really great read. It's great to have you with us.
Thank you for having me.
We're so happy you could squeeze us in. You're on a whirlwind tour. And my goodness, this book is getting so much attention.
It's exciting, and it's kind of beyond my wildest imaginings. And my imaginings are pretty wild, as a rule.
I do want to let listeners know that we had gotten very excited to see you were coming to Denver and had reached out to see if you could come and be on the book club before Oprah Winfrey made her announcement. We got there first, but Oprah, of course, has the platform. What is that like to be chosen by Oprah Winfrey?
You know, when I wrote my first novel, published my first novel in 2002, it was just when she announced that she was shutting down the book club. And I remember I was so disappointed, like I had been told that, you know, there would be no more Christmas ever. And so I kind of put that dream away, like, it's just not going to happen. And then one day I was just driving my car and the phone rang and it said block call. And I'm the kind of person that when I see block call, I become intrigued. I was like, And I said, hello. And the voice on the other end said, hi, this is Oprah.
Oprah herself actually called
you.
She
just rolled up on me.
Wow.
I pulled over.
I'm glad.
Yeah, better than crashing. Well, it's a great book, so you have three characters in this book. There's a marriage between Roy and Celestial, and Celestial's best friend, Andre, from her childhood, who's also Roy's friend, who introduced them. They all kind of end up enmeshed because Roy goes away to prison. And so this really gets the events of the book in motion. Had this been an idea you've had for a long time? Dealing with, you know, really what prison does to relationships or what hardships, you know, come in relationships.
You know, actually, I had the idea to write this for this novel. It's the first time that I really, really reached out far away from my autobiography. So I wrote a grant to go to Harvard University to do some research on mass incarceration. I identified this as a social problem I wanted to address and I wanted to help. And the only thing I have to help with is my writing. So I did all this research. I read all these sociological texts. I read oral histories. I watched documentaries. I did all this research, but I was angry. I was outraged, but I wasn't inspired. I didn't have a story, and I didn't know what I was going to do. Just think about it. I've accepted this grant to Harvard, and they want some evidence of my work, and I have been working, but all I had were post-it notes and index cards, but no art. But I went to Atlanta to visit my mother, and while I was there, I went to the mall, and I overheard a couple arguing. The woman said, "Roy, you know you wouldn't have waited on me for 7 years." And I'm nosy anyway, but I was struck by the fact that they were so obviously in love and in trouble. And he said back to her, "I don't know what you're talking about because this wouldn't have happened to you in the first place." Mm-hmm. And when that happened, I know I have a novel when both characters have a point. I didn't know him, but I was fairly confident that he wouldn't have waited on her for 7 years. But he was right. It probably wouldn't have happened to her. And that's where I got this idea of a young couple married only 18 months, separated by his wrongful incarceration.
I mean, we should really point that out to the listener. It's not just about incarceration. He is completely innocent. And there's no ambiguity about that at all. And so that underlies the entire feeling of kind of outrage about what's happening.
And also it puts so much of the responsibility of their, how they choose to maintain their relationship on each other. Because if he had been guilty of the crime of which he was convicted, then the question would be, should she wait on a criminal? You know, like that. Like, it would just be all about, well, he made his bed, he has to lie in it. And I felt like that distracts from the question I'm asking, which is the way that separation and, you know, her husband is a hostage of the state, how that affects something as big as being a hostage of the state. I mean, that's a political problem. How does that then affect the way people interact personally? Love is personal.
Well, how you deal with that separation time is through letters, that they're sending letters back and forth. And I thought that was a very interesting way to do it, because what we get from Roy's time in prison is what he's willing to tell his wife.
Yes.
And I thought that was very, you're not getting the pure, what he might say in his own head all the time. It's just what he's willing to tell his wife and how much of he wants to put on her, and to some extent, how much he's willing to share with her of and what he's going through.
And the letters, just think about it. You know, letter writing, they literally have a small canvas on which to make their relationship, a small piece of paper. This is all they have. And also, you know, when you read a book, you are vicariously experiencing what the characters experience. Prison is harrowing. I did not want to send my reader to prison. I felt like, as a novelist, that's one of the kind of a mercy I could extend my readers by trying to figure out the small details that give you a feeling of the deprivation, the confinement, the potential loss, without you having to vicariously actually experience it.
I thought that was so well done, because I think any more details about his incarceration and his experience would have overwhelmed the story and taken away from the central message about what happens to a relationship when one person is essentially, as you said, a hostage of the state. I think if there were a lot more details about him being in prison beyond what he wanted to reveal to Celestial through letters, it would have so overwhelmed everything.
It would have become about prison and not about them. It was so hard to keep steering the story. I felt like I was trying to steer a cruise ship, because any of the details, the fact that he is in prison at all, the fact that he is wrongfully incarcerated, these things could so easily become the center of the story and their relationship be lost.
You actually write the story from the perspective of three different people. There's Celestial, then there's Roy, so the married couple involved, but then there's Andre, who plays a significant role as Celestial's childhood friend. And did you ever think, I'll just write the story from one perspective? I mean, what was that as a technique, and what were some of the challenges of that?
Well, the first time I wrote the novel three times. The first time I wrote it entirely from her point of view, because I was interested in her. She's an artist. She's trying to figure out, I mean, on some level, she's struggling with the work-life balance like so many other women, except her husband is incarcerated wrongfully, so everything is like turned up to 20 for her. But her conflicts are familiar to me. And so I wrote the whole thing from her point of view. But it didn't feel like the entire truth. It didn't seem like it. You could really tell this story without Roy weighing in, because he's having this, you know, this really profound experience of having everything taken from him. So then I rewrote the whole book from Roy's point of view. And it was easier to write than Celestial's point of view, even though I'm a woman. And I realized it's because stories like Roy's are the way all my life I have understood stories of racial injustice. A man against the system, a man with a problem, and all he wants is to find a virtuous woman at the other end. And I realized I understood that as an African-American narrative. But also, I mean, like everybody else, I did read the Odyssey in high school, and that is the same story. And then it occurred to me, when I realized this was like the Odyssey, I said, this is a modern story, but Roy wants what Odysseus wanted in what? That's like, what, 300 BC? So Roy wants something that old. And Celestial is a modern person, and she wants a modern life. And I discovered that when the going gets tough, people get conservative, because he wasn't like that before he went to prison. He liked that she had a career. He liked that she was well known for her artwork. He loved these things about her that she didn't say obey when they got married. But when he gets incarcerated, he wants something very, very old, very antiquated.
Well, it seemed to me to some extent he wants at the very least things frozen. He probably wants things more than that. Like, you know, she, as her career goes on, he has anger about that. You know, this was our dream together, and now you're doing something kind of different than our dream. You said it was a dream adjacent, was what the phrase in the book, but this is beyond that. You're now, you know, in the magazine, in Ebony magazine, and have started this store on your own. And he has almost some anger comes through in those letters. Not, I don't know if anger is the right word, but fear of being left behind. Or
he's afraid and he's angry. He's having all the feelings. He kind of tickles me a little bit, Roy, because on the one hand, he's like, I don't want you to stop your life for me. I don't want you to wait on me. And then he says, wait, what? Your life goes on. And it's such a tricky thing, because yes, in a way, he does want her to be frozen in time with him. They can, because his life is frozen, and so then they can be frozen together, but they can't be. And it's just so hard for both of them, because I do think even when one's husband is not wrongfully incarcerated, there is tension in relationships when one person's career thrives, particularly if that person is the woman, because it just upsets our understanding of relationships and power between men and women.
We're speaking with author Tiari Jones today on KGNU's Radio Book Club, a collaboration between KGNU and the Boulder Bookstore. I'm Maeve Conran, and Arsene Kashkashian of the Boulder Bookstore, as always, my co-host. And Tiari's new novel is An American Marriage. And the marriage in question is that between Celestial and Roy, but it is certainly interrupted when Roy is incarcerated for a crime he certainly did not commit. And that's the exploration of what happens to a relationship when that happens. Now, Celestial, we're saying she's an artist. She's a very interesting artist, because she makes baby dolls, but artistic baby dolls that all seem to look like Roy when he was a baby.
Many of them, not all of them, but many of them do look like Roy. I mean, even though he feels in many ways that she has gone on without him, but she will never go on without him. She will just go on. And the doll she makes, I think she negotiates her memory of him through making these dolls. And she also makes dolls that look like her parents. She is recreating the people she loves through her art. And Roy, at first, really loves that she makes art, because she made art that looked like him before he was incarcerated. But when they seemed to be merely tribute to him, he was delighted by it. But when she starts to use her dolls to kind of sort out her feelings or think about what are the implications of his predicament, he becomes uncomfortable when he is the subject of art in a way that's more rigorous.
Well, and the baby doll aspect is intriguing, because one of the big tensions that they have, even prior to the incarceration, is whether or not to have a baby, or at what point to have a baby. And yet she creates these baby dolls, and yet there's a tension as to whether to have an actual baby in their relationship.
Well, having a doll is really different than having a baby. But she isn't sure if she wants to have a baby, but she didn't know. Like, I know when I was coming up, I thought that when you grew up, you got married and you had a baby, just like kind of when you finished high school, you would go to college, that there were just life steps that you didn't choose them or not choose them. They were just as predictable as the seasons. And with Celestial, when she got to an age when she realized that these things were, in fact, optional. But she also has a certain guilt, too, because of class. You know, she is an upper middle class professional Black woman. And one of her mentors says to her, have a baby, save the race. And it's a joke, but it's not a joke. And there is also that sense. She has so much responsibility, so many implications of how she lives her life. And then again, there's always the question of love. Love is such a personal thing. She and Roy are quite a passionate couple, but they've only been married 18 months when this happens to him.
And they have some struggles before the incarceration. So this tension and this going, not being able to stay frozen, and you know, and there's a, they start going their own way. I mean, even though Roy is kind of standing still, she's moving on with her life, and eventually the inevitable happens. And I would like you to read a passage from a letter that she writes that was very painful.
Dear Roy, this is the letter I promised that I would never send. Before I go any farther, I want to tell you that I'm sorry. I want to tell you that even typing these words is killing me. I won't say that this will hurt me more than it hurts you, because I know how much you're hurting every day, and no matter what is happening to me, it will never compare. I understand that I'm not in the same agony as you are, but I'm in pain, and I cannot continue to live this way. I can't go on being your wife. In some ways, I feel like I never even got a chance to try my hand at that role. We were only married a year and a half before lightning struck, counting off time and months like you do with a baby. I have done my best to be married without actually being a wife for 3 years now. You're going to think this is about another man, but this is about the two of us, about our delicate cord that has been shredded by your incarceration. At your mother's funeral, your father showed what the connection is between husband and wife. If he could have, he would have gone into the grave instead of her. But they lived under one roof for more than 30 years. In some ways, they grew together and grew up together, and had she not died, they would have grown old together. That's what a marriage is. What we have here isn't a marriage. A marriage is more than your heart. It's your life, and we're not sharing ours. I blame it on time, not on you or me. If we put a penny in the jar for every day we've been married, and we took a penny away for every day we've been apart, the jar would have been depleted a long time ago. I've been trying to find ways to add more pennies, but our visits in that busy room at that sad table send me home with empty hands. I know this, and you do too. The last 3 times I have visited, we have said almost nothing to each other. You can't bear to hear about my days, and I can't bear to hear about yours. I'm not abandoning you. I will never abandon you. My uncle will continue to file appeals. I'll continue to keep your commissary up to date, and I'll visit you every month. I can come as your friend, as your ally, as your sister. You're part of my family, Roy, and you always will be, but I can't be your wife. Love, and I mean it, Celestial.
Was that painful to write?
You know, it was difficult to write the first draft of it, but then I had to keep revising it because I knew how harshly some readers would judge her. And I had to make, so as she is convincing him that she's not a bad person and that she has tried, I was also aware in the revision that I had to convince a reader, because that letter completely upsets all our expectations of what we think this story will be about. When I was first writing it, I would say to people, I'm writing a novel about a woman and her husband has been wrongfully incarcerated. And people would say, oh, and this is a book about her brave fight to free him. And when I chose to make a different focus, I knew that I was kind of swimming uphill, because when you upset readers' expectations, you have to work very hard to keep them on board.
Mm-hmm. Do you feel that you have gotten some pushback, or do you feel that you've been successful in what you're trying to do with that character?
Sometimes I feel successful. Sometimes I have book events and I feel like it might, you know, come break out into a brawl. I might have to, you know, separate the people. Someone said they wanted to, I should make T-shirts that say Team Roy or Team Andre. And I was like, please don't say that, because if you feel there's a team, I feel that I've failed as a writer. I wanted to make it where readers feel very torn and unsure. So I said, if there were to be Team Roy, Team Andre shirts, and there will not be, but were they to be, it would have to be shirts that had one on the front and one on the back.
Well, I think that is the balance that you did strike, you know, masterfully in the book, because it would have been so easy to just pick one team and really take the perspective that resonates most with you. But you see the nuance in all of this. And when you're reading, when you read that letter that Celestial wrote, you're like, yeah, they were hardly together. They were together less than the time they've been apart now. And at what point does that balance of time outweigh the time that you spent together?
And the thing that makes it so nerve-wracking for both of them is that it's hard to say what it is that tore them apart. There's a moment toward the end when someone says to Celestial, she pours out her story about her husband, and he says to her, that's a rough story, but incarceration is hard, but time is the original mother. You know, that's what he says. Mm-hmm. And he says, I was married. I went away from my wife for 6 months, and I came back, and the marriage was shot. So, I mean, you don't even know if the marriage would have lasted or how it would have lasted. But the fact of his incarceration and the fact that he is, as Celestial father said, a hostage of the state makes everything Celestial does so symbolic. And it becomes about loyalty, not only to Roy, but loyalty to a cause, race loyalty, all of this. And I feel at some point her desires become almost irrelevant, that it's important that she behave symbolically. But should she view Roy symbolically? Anytime you view someone symbolically, you undermine their humanity.
That's author Tiari Jones joining us at the Radio Book Club. Her new book, An American Marriage, The Marriage in Question, Celestial and Roy's, which is really torn asunder because of the separation due to his incarceration. And he is innocent, but he's incarcerated. So you've a lot of weight on there. You said the nugget of this came, well, originally you were at Harvard and you wanted to explore incarceration, but then you weren't quite sure how to do it. And then you overheard an argument in a shopping mall where a woman said to character Roy, a person Roy, you wouldn't have waited for me. Did you talk to families or couples or women or men who have lived through this type of experience and this type of separation?
I have. And I, you know, actually, I just know such people in real life. I mean, that is the thing about mass incarceration. The reason they call it mass is because it happens to so many people. I know a number of people who have husbands, lovers, brothers, and this negotiating this incarceration, and different people in real life handle it different ways. I feel sometimes that when we read books, we imagine ourselves as our very highest self and how we would behave. But the idea of postponing all of your dreams in your life, especially as a young person, it's an insurmountable challenge, and some people rise to it. I mean, there's some people who become empowered by waiting. It gives a nobility to their relationship. And there are other people who feel stymied by it. It just really is going to depend on your personality. That's one thing I discovered in writing. Oh, there's so many marriages in this novel. And what makes a marriage work simply seems to be whether the people are on the same page. Because Roy's parents, people often describe their relationship as so strong. But for me, I would just hate to be in that marriage. They don't even have friends. Roy's parents, all they do is each other. But it works for them because neither of them seems to want any friends. They only want each other. So it works if both people want the same thing. And when one person, when Roy is incarcerated and Celestial is not, the power dynamic is so different. Like, his being faithful makes him stronger. His commitment to their relationship gives him strength because that's what he has. She represents the hope of perhaps getting out. She also is the nostalgia for what they had. But for her to be dedicated to the relationship with him, it limits her freedom.
He's really idealized her once he's in prison. Like, we talked about this a little earlier, that he's changed his conception of what he wants, and I think he's changed what he's looking for in her is different than when he went in. And I think that's interesting. The other interesting thing I wanted to touch upon real quickly is there's a lot of fathers in this book, and you know, they're strong characters. Celestial's father, Franklin, who's made himself a self-made millionaire. Roy's father, Big Roy. Even Andre's father, who is absent, comes in for a critical scene towards the end. Andre actually calls on his father, who he barely has a relationship. And I thought that was really interesting how important these men were in the life and what was happening to these characters, Did you envision it like that, or was that organic as you just started writing about these characters and that these different men started playing roles?
Well, I'm very close to my father, and I have two brothers and two sisters, and between us, we have three mothers, and we have one father, and I'm very close. I'm such a daddy's girl. You know, one of my memories of myself, you know how you ride on his shoulders and you hold on to his ears. And I was that girl. But my brothers and sisters, we each have a very different relationship with him. And I've just been fascinated at the way that men and fatherhood can be so different contextually. So I feel like we have five different fathers. And someone pointed out to me that every one of my books are about people and their fathers. And I find him fascinating, and I think he finds me fascinating as well. And I think that's why he keeps coming back in my writing. Like, I look at him and I think, who is Daddy exactly? Like, I know who Daddy is to me, but my sisters each have a different relationship. My brothers each have a different relationship, but he's the same Daddy. How is this possible?
Mm-hmm. I thought it was interesting. A lot of times in African-American fiction, or the stereotype is that there's fathers are missing or the father isn't present. And you had so many fathers that were present. And I felt that was very satisfying. And those fathers were important characters in different ways. And none of them felt stereotyped or pigeonholed or anything. They're all different people but fathering in different ways.
They are. All of them are fathering their little hearts out, even when they father poorly. They all have a distinct idea of what it means to be a father, and they don't think of themselves. Even Andre's absent father, who lives like a mile away, he's fathering someone else. I mean, that's another thing about fathers, is that you can be a deadbeat dad to one kid and be a attentive dad to a child in a different relationship. Because I think it's because men, where they live determines their relationship with their children. And with mothers, they tend to have all their children with them. Even if they have different fathers, they're all under one roof, and the negotiation of the relationship is different. But I didn't feel like people sometimes say, were you trying to undermine the stereotype of Black fathers? But for me, I believe all stereotypes are lies. So if you write a true book, your characters won't be stereotyped. Like, even Roy's biological father, whom we meet in the book, is like the deadbeat of deadbeats, but he's funny, and he has a defense of his behavior, and he makes a very good point to Roy that you did have a father. Roy was raised by a loving stepfather. You were, so don't be, he feels like, don't be mad at me. It's not like you weren't raised. And that is a legitimate point. And as Roy says, he would have been a terrible father to me in my real life.
But he steps in at a very crucial point in Roy's life, not to give too much of the plot away, but it was very interesting how he comes back into Roy's life and really steps in the role of a father.
Yes. Yeah, so even though he would have been a terrible father, as Roy says, in real life, he is needed in a different way. And I do believe in letting people have second chances. I mean, that was a big challenge for me in writing this book. I felt that all of these characters had suffered so much. I got stranded 40 pages out from the end because I needed to figure out how I could work it out for them, because part of what I do in fiction is to try to imagine a different world for us. So I try to write extremely realistic fiction, and then I was trying to find an extremely realistic yet satisfying ending. And I was just stranded there for almost 2 years.
And what was the tipping point? What kind of got you to where ultimately it is, which is a very satisfying ending?
I realized that I was letting Roy Othaniel Hamilton drag me through this book. I was letting Roy feels that because he has been, you know, wrongfully incarcerated, that this book is about him reclaiming what he has lost. He thinks he's lost his money, his wife, his house. And I was letting him convince me that this is what he had lost. But I realized that what he really had lost was his ability or an obligation to have empathy for others. He felt he had suffered so much that it was about everyone else giving back to him. But empathy is how we are citizens of our own lives. It's how empathy is how you are a citizen in your relationship, in your family, in your community, in your nation, what you can give back. And so this is really a story about Roy regaining his citizenship, not regaining his money, his house, his job, how he can become a member of his own life again.
And that's Tiare Jones. What a great way to end our Radio Book Club edition. An American Marriage is her new novel. And thank you so much for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
At the end of our book club interviews, we always announce the next book that we're inviting listeners to read along with us. Arson, what have you selected?
We're going to be reading Elizabeth Hyde's book, Go Ask Fanny. And this is a book about a family in New Hampshire that has some mysteries that become start being solved when one of the members brings to a reunion an old cookbook that the late mother had, and they start going through and finding some secrets in the past. So that's Elizabeth Hyde. She's a local author, and we'll have her.
That's on the 4th Thursday of May, but we actually taped that at live at the Boulder Bookstore on Independent Booksellers Day. But you can find out more about this, the book club online at news.kgnu.org. And don't forget to subscribe to the podcast, particularly for After Hours at the Radio Book Club. And we'll have a little bit more in conversation with Tiare Jones. For KGNU, I'm Maeve Conran.